is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Israeli military saying on Monday, four more of the Israeli hostages abducted by Hamas on October 7th have died in captivity. Four men were identified as two 80-year-olds, an 84-year-old, and a 51-year-old. Military spokesperson Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari said new intelligence led to the confirmation of their deaths. Of the more than 250 abducted on October 7th, about 120 remain in Gaza, according to Israeli tallies. Many have been declared dead by Israeli authorities. The United States has not yet heard back from Hamas on a ceasefire proposal that was submitted to the group on Thursday. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller told reporters on Monday.
It was an Israeli proposal. Obviously, it was a proposal that they developed in consultation with the United States and Qatar and Egypt, the three countries that have played the mediating role throughout this process, but this was ultimately an Israeli proposal.
An aide to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu confirmed on Sunday Israel had accepted the framework deal for winding down the Gaza war, now being advanced by U.S. President Joe Biden, though he described it as flawed and in need of much more work. Dr. Anthony Fauci was back before Congress calling Republican allegations that he tried to over and cover up COVID-19 origins simply preposterous. Top U.S. infectious disease expert till 2022. Fauci was grilled by the House panel behind closed doors in January. On Monday, they questioned him again in public and on camera. The Republican-led subcommittee has spent over a year probing the nation's response to the pandemic and whether or not U.S.-funded research in China may have played a role in how it started. This is VOA News. India has on Tuesday begun counting more than 640 million votes in the world's largest democratic exercise, which is widely expected to be return of Prime Minister Narendra Modi to a third term after a decade in power. The six-week-long election was seen as a referendum on Modi. If the 73-year-old wins, it will only be the second time an Indian leader has retained power for a third term. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports President Biden is preparing to roll out an executive order that would shut down asylum requests at the southern border after 25 migrants arrive in a day.
The White House is preparing a tough executive order that would shut down asylum requests at the southern border after 2,500 migrants arrive a day. It would be President Biden's most aggressive unilateral move yet to control numbers at the border. The 2,500 figure is important because it means the border could effectively be closed to asylum seekers immediately, because daily figures are higher than that now. Several officials say the White House is telling lawmakers the president's getting ready to sign off on the order and unveil it tomorrow at an event with border mayors at the White House. He's been deliberating more immigration action on his own for months after a bipartisan asylum bill fell apart at Donald Trump's urging. Sagar Magani, Washington.
AP correspondent Michael Kunzelman reports that a jury has been seated in the Hunter Biden federal gun case as a first lady watched from the front row of the courtroom.
On the main jury, there are six men and six women, and then four women are among the alternates. And tomorrow morning, starting at 9 o'clock, they will hear the opening statements from attorneys in the case. The first witness is expected to be an FBI agent who investigated the case. So Hunter Biden is charged with three felony counts related to the purchase of a gun in 2018. Two of them are for false statements that he allegedly made in applying for the gun when he said that he was not an addict, when in fact, I think he's admitted as much in his memoir, and the government alleges that he was an addict at the time he made that gun purchase and lied about it.
AP correspondent Michael Kunzelman. Pro-Brexit anti-immigration campaigner Nigel Farage is now returning to frontline British politics. He announced Monday that he will take the helm of the right-wing party Reform UK and run for Parliament in the July 4th election. He said he'll run in a seaside town of Clacton-on-Sea in his eighth attempt to win a seat. Announcement came just after Farage said he would not be a candidate because it was more important to support his ally, Donald Trump, in the U.S. presidential election. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
America. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, June 4th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Africa's ANC to soon start closely watched coalition talks.
We have to understand that to go into a coalition with the Democratic Alliance, which is the official opposition, is seen as, by some, as a betrayal of the revolution.
Chadian women contest under representation in governance. Zimbabwe authorities urge citizens to cycle to work. The son of former Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf dies. A Ugandan anti-corruption official is concerned about the lack of confidence in the country's fight against graft. Nigeria labor unions reach a tentative agreement with the government over minimum wage.
This will be taken to the joint meeting of the National Executive Councils of the Nigerian Labour Congress and the Trade Union Congress. If they accept, then that agreement will become binding. But if they reject it, then the strike continues.
And former President Donald Trump returns to the campaign trail after guilty verdicts. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Talks to form South Africa's first national coalition government are expected to begin this week after the governing ANC party lost its majority for the first time. Kate Bartlett reports from Johannesburg on the issues and the challenges faced by the political parties involved.
Despite the heavy blow his African National Congress party took at the polls, President Cyril Ramaphosa showed humor at a ceremony announcing the official South African election results Sunday night. After an Electoral Commission official misspoke in welcoming the guests to the ceremony, Ramaphosa retorted that he was distinguished and not yet extinguished, drawing a laugh from the politicians and media gathered. But on a more serious note, the president pledged that the ANC, which got 40% of the vote, would work with other parties to find common ground as coalition talks get underway. The ANC has had a majority for 30 years since the end of apartheid, so governing in a coalition marks uncharted territory. Under the law, parties now have 2 weeks to form a government, with South Africans on edge about what form that could take. There are several main options. Melanie Vovut, a former ANC Member of Parliament and diplomat who's now a political analyst, told VOA.
There are a number of coalition options and permutations that can happen in the next 2 weeks. The first one is obviously a formal coalition with the Democratic Alliance and the IFP.
The IFP is the Inkatha Freedom Party, a small opposition party popular with the Zulu people. The Democratic Alliance is a centrist party and South Africa's main opposition. It took 21% of the vote in the elections. Big business and Western powers would favor a coalition with the DA, which observers say has a good track record in areas it's been in charge of locally. However, it is led by a white man, John Steenhuisen, which is a huge optics problem for many in South Africa because of the country's history, noted David Everett, a professor at Johannesburg's Fitz School of Governance.
We have to understand that to go into a coalition with the Democratic Alliance, which is the official opposition, is seen as, by some, as a betrayal of the revolution.
Former MP Vovut said those in the ANC who balk at a coalition with the DA have another option, involving the radical left-wing Economic Freedom Fighters, EFF, or former President Jacob Zuma's new Umkhonto we Sizwe party, or MK.
Then, of course, there is the more troubling one, which is an ANC-EFF coalition or an ANC-MK coalition, neither which the ANC favors as a first option because it would affect the markets quite negatively and also very concerned about the stability of such a coalition.
The populist MK party got the third highest number of votes and was a game changer in this election, despite Zuma having to resign in disgrace from the presidency in 2018 amid numerous corruption scandals. Zuma is a sworn enemy of Ramaphosa, and the MK party has said they will not go into a coalition with what they call the ANC of Ramaphosa. The EFF, led by firebrand politician Julius Malema, came fourth at the polls and wants expropriation without compensation of land, as well as nationalization of the mines and banks. Steenhuisen on Sunday called the possibility of an ANC-EFF agreement a doomsday coalition and promised the DA would engage in talks to try and prevent it from happening. On Tuesday, the ANC's top brass is set to discuss coalitions. The party has publicly stated that Ramaphosa staying on as president is non-negotiable. Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Child female leaders and activists have strongly condemned what they say is their negligible representation in President Mahamat Idriss Deby's first civilian government after a three-year transition from military rule. The women voiced their concerns during a meeting in Chad's capital, N'Djamena, on Monday. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from neighboring Cameroon.
Several dozen female activists and opposition members say they are upset with what they call Chadian President Mahamat Idriss Deby's decision to exclude them from political issues in the first civilian government. The women who met in Chad's capital N'Djamena on Monday said Deby should have rejected the government appointed by new Prime Minister Alamaye Halina last week. Halina was appointed by Deby to replace Success Masra, who resigned after his defeat in Chad's May 6 presidential election. Masra was in office for 4 months. Amina Tijani Yaya is the coordinator of Voix de la Femme, or Women's Voice, a non-governmental organization that advocates for the respect of women's rights and political participation. She says female leaders and activists do not understand why Chad's new Prime Minister, Alamaye Halina, decided to reduce the number of female ministers from 12 during Chad's three-year transitional period to 8 in the first civilian government he appointed on May 27. Yaya says Chadian officials have not respected the resolution of the Central African Nations 2022 Inclusive and Sovereign National Dialogue, which states that more women should be appointed to government positions. Chad's new government has 35 ministers. 23 served in the previous administration before Deby was declared the winner of Chad's May 6 presidential election, ending 3 years of military transition, returning to constitutional order. The women said Deby should have involved more women in the current government because Chad is a signatory to the Maputo Protocol, a commitment by African nations through the African Union to ensure gender equality in political decision-making. Chad's government has not responded to the women's request for more representation in politics. Moki Edwin Kinzeka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
The federal government of Nigeria and organized labor signed an agreement late Monday night over the minimum wage controversy. The Nigeria Labor Congress and the Trade Union Congress began an indefinite nationwide strike on Monday, June 3rd, over a new national minimum wage and for the government to reverse the hike in the electricity tariff. The strike paralyzed much of the country on Monday. Benson Upa is the head of information and public affairs at the Nigeria Labor Congress. He tells me the union hierarchy will have to approve the tentative agreement.
I mean, the agreement is a loose one. Yeah, the main thrust of the agreement is that government has committed to paying something higher than 60,000 naira. This will be taken to the joint meeting of the National Executive Councils of the Nigerian Labor Congress and the Trade Union Congress. If they accept, then that agreement will become binding. But if they reject it, then the strike continues.
It seems to me, because I saw an agreement earlier signed by the government and leaders of the labor movement.
Yes.
Does that mean they agree with what is in that agreement? Because the government is saying it wants to give this amount, but labor has not yet said that amount is acceptable.
Yes, because labor will have to take this back to the expanded organs. You remember that the mandate the organs gave them was 494. But now government is saying we're going to give you something far, far less than that. So it was important for them to say, well, yes, on our own part, we have heard you, but we have to go back and meet with our people.
Help me understand, please. I saw an article or maybe communication that
the government had deployed the military at the venue where the meeting was being held. Is that true?
Yes, government did that. But arising from the articles, from all of that, a government now said, well, they deployed the military at the venue not to intimidate or to arrest, but because of the presence of the National Security Advisor. They explained it away, but of course we are not convinced. But eventually I understand that the presence of the military was considerably scaled down.
Now, the government has offered to pay more than 60,000 naira. What is 60,000 in U.S. dollars?
At the present exchange rate, 60,000 will translate to no more than $37.
That's the minimum wage?
The minimum wage. Just about 37, 38, but certainly not more than $40.
Per day?
Mr. Botti, you can see why we are fighting.
So we can assume that there will be more negotiations coming up now.
Yes, I think so too, because this actually goes to no issue.
We thank you so much for staying up until this morning to speak with us. Thank you very much.
Yes, it's my pleasure. Thank you, Mr. Botti.
Benson Opar is the head of Information and Public Affairs at the Nigerian Labour Congress. He was speaking with us from Abuja. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Tuesday, June 4th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The executive director of the Anti-Corruption Coalition is expressing a lack of confidence in Uganda's fight against graft and wrongdoing. Marlon Agaba also says he expects President Yoweri Museveni to renew calls for the fight against corruption in the coming State of the Nation address on June 6. Agaba's remarks come after the president declared war on corruption public officials at a ceremony over the weekend. For more about the fight against fraud, graft, and malfeasance in Uganda, VOA's Peter Clotty reached Marlon Agaba.
It is not the first time the president is declaring war on corruption. He has said it on several occasions that he's going to fight the corrupt. In fact, he has called them weevils, that he has called them parasites, that he's going to root them out. So the rhetoric has been going on. And unless we really see any serious action, then there is no optimism at all. Because, one, if it is in terms of rhetoric, he has spoken on several occasions saying he's going to deal with the corrupt, but we haven't seen any serious action being taken. So the president's statements over the weekend, they don't change anything much in terms of fighting corruption. It's still part of the same game. And unless there is real action taken by the president, especially addressing the political corruption among the political elite and within his government, then we cannot take him seriously.
Well, some are suggesting that he appears to have a renewed call following sanctions imposed by Western nations, including the U.S. and the U.K., on Anita Among and other senior government officials over graft allegations.
Certainly, of course, there is a little bit of pressure within government because of the sanctions that were announced. They are unprecedented in his government. Of course, many excesses have been done in terms of corruption, in terms of human rights abuses, but we hadn't reached the extent of having sanctions being pronounced on high-ranking government officials. So definitely there is pressure on him to act, and we have seen him writing the letters here and there and urging the different agencies of government to take action. But unless we reach, see a real change in terms of the actions being taken, then there is no cause for optimism, because the same people are still in government. Like the speaker today is representing him at the function of the Uganda matters. Unless really we see, and one of the ministers who was sanctioned, the Honorable Amos Ogborobi, is still in his cabinet. So unless we see reaction from him, then really there is nothing much really to, and even the other government officials have been saying that the sanctions are unfortunate, they are not welcome, that they are biased, that is because Uganda passed the Anti-Homosexuality Act. So you can say that yes, the sanctions have caused some bit of fear among the government officials, but by and large it is still business as usual.
Malung Agaba is the executive director of the Anti-Corruption Coalition of Uganda. He was speaking with viewers Peter Clotty. Faced with a broken public transit system, poor road conditions, fuel shortages, and low salaries, Zimbabwean authorities are urging citizens to cycle to work for health reasons and to promote a clean environment, as bicycles do not use fossil fuels. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, where workers say the government should rehabilitate cycling lanes to avoid road accidents.
Jacob Mofume, the mayor of Harare, says if Zimbabweans in greater numbers chose to cycle to work, there would be less congestion and fewer road accidents. That's not all, says Mofume.
Most of the health problems that we have in our society now is that we are sitting all the time. We sit at home, we sit at work, we sit in the car as we come there. So it does not help a society to be built on unhealthy practices. But also, it is also cheaper on the budget. People can focus on other issues like housing, education, and even investment if they are on bicycles. And also, it is environmentally friendly. It has less impact on our environment.
Ngoni Nyamadzao is a part-time gardener in Zimbabwe's affluent suburbs and cycles daily as a way to reduce costs to save his average salary of $150 a month. He says, I see cycling as a saving measure. If I did not cycle, I would use $30 a month for transport. Sergio Tarwire works for a local NGO, Trees, Knowers and Growers, which advocates for more trees. He cycles daily and encourages Zimbabweans to join him. Tarwire says cycling has so many physical benefits. Driving is not good for the environment as cars release dirt into the atmosphere. As an organization of Trees, Knowers and Growers, we encourage people to cycle. If I was using public transport, I would be paying $4 daily. At the end of the month, it would be a lot of money. So cycling is good for health and for the pocket. Tarwire said he would like the city of Harare to rehabilitate cycling tracks which have been neglected for years. Mayor Mafume says he is aware of the dilapidated state of cycling lanes in the capital city.
We are going to revamp them. One of the issues that we have to do is to put a cycle track running right across Harare Drive. Once we have a cycle track cycling the city, then all the other cycle tracks can fit into Harare Drive.
Harare Drive is the city's longest drive and circles Harare. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News, Harare.
The son of former Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, Charles Sirleaf, has died. The Liberian front page Africa newspaper, citing family sources, says he died Monday in Ghana at the age of 68. As Denise Nipson tells us from Monrovia, the late Charles Sirleaf served as acting governor of the Central Bank of Liberia.
Charles Sirleaf died in Ghana at age 68. During the morning hours of Monday, according to family source, he was due to travel to India for heart surgery, but unfortunately, on Monday morning, he died in his sleep.
So, Denise, apart from being the son of a former president, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, we understand that the late Charles Sirleaf was also involved in Liberian politics and economy. What can you tell us?
Exactly. He was a seasoned economist and financial expert because all of his days in government, he was working with financial institutions dated back to 1990 when he started some active work in Liberia before his demise His immediate job was the Central Bank of Liberia, where he served as deputy governor of the Central Bank of Liberia. So he's known for his work in the financial setting of Liberia. He was a financial expert.
The news just broke on Monday. How do you think Liberians are receiving the news? And also, the late Charles Sirleaf's mother, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, has the former president made any comments so far?
Currently, a lot of Liberians are surprised hearing the news of the death of Charles Sirleaf. It came as a surprise. Currently, the former president, Madam Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, has not made any public pronouncement or statement as it relates to the death of her son. But the president, Joseph Boakai, who is not in country, according to the executive mansion, he phoned into Madam Sirleaf in Liberia and extended his condolences to the family on behalf of the government for the loss of her son.
Dennis, thank you so much. Good talking with you.
Thank you, sir.
House reporter Dennis Nipsen speaking with us from the Liberian capital, Monrovia. Donald Trump returns to a political campaigning this week as the first convicted felon to run for U.S. president as a major party candidate. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns looks at how voters are reacting to the verdict on the campaign trail.
Donald Trump supporters continued to cheer their candidate outside New York's Trump Tower a day after the former president was convicted of 34 felony counts of falsifying business records in a scheme to illegally influence the results of his 2016 election. In the city's Chelsea neighborhood, voter Nicholas Warner says the conviction was horrible and the country needs a second Trump term.
When he was in office for 4 years, we had nothing like we have going on now with the war and everything else, all the freaking, you know, the economy and inflation. So I just would like him to come back so we can just take care of business like a businessman and get this country where it's got to go.
In Maryland, voter Arkady Lapidus says Trump's claim that his trial was rigged is not good for the Republican Party or for the country.
There is nothing until this party dumps Donald Trump, says we believe in elections, we believe in the courts, we believe in juries who hand down verdicts because they're fellow Americans. Until the party wholesale, like, espouses American values as I see them, I will never vote Republican again.
Voter Margaret Barnes says that even with a felony conviction, Trump is more believable than Joe Biden.
Biden just strikes me as being fake, and he's just fake sentimentality, just telling stories as if he's this nice old man when, you know, it's just artificial. I don't believe him. It's insincere. And with Trump, he's bombastic, and he's, you know, in that world of gold toilets and champagne and caviar and golf courses and Saudi princes. But even though what he says can be offensive, I believe him a lot more.
In Colorado, voter Luda Golodnik says Trump's conviction is deserved, and she hopes it hurts his campaign.
The way that he speaks about women, the way that he treats other countries, the way that he talks about illegal immigrants, and being married to an immigrant also, it just, like, he's had what he's had coming a long way.
In Nevada, voter Keith Dayton says the verdict has no impact on his vote.
I'm still voting for Donald Trump. I think this whole thing has been a mockery. I'm embarrassed for our country. I wouldn't have him over for a beer or go to the pub with him. But that's not what it's about.
In the electoral swing state of Pennsylvania, the verdict may boost Trump supporters, says voter Jeffrey Nesbitt.
I think it will be much more effective for the American people to just beat him and his movement at the polls. I think that there's a good possibility that this verdict may motivate his movement to come out and vote even more aggressively and act more aggressively in this upcoming election.
90% of registered Republicans still back Trump, according to a Reuters Ipsos poll. That remaining 10% of Republicans, now less likely to vote for Trump, could make a difference in a close election where both candidates need to hold their bases and win independent voters. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
And that's it for this Tuesday, June 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your morning with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing that you will have an amazing Tuesday.